The positive energy of the outgoing radiation will be balanced by a flow of negative energy particles into the black hole. By Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, where E is energy, m is mass, and c is the speed of light, energy is proportional to mass. A flow of negative energy into the black hole therefore reduces its mass. As the black hole loses mass, the area of its event horizon gets smaller, but this decrease in the entropy of the black hole is more than compensated for by the entropy of the emitted radiation, so the second law is never violated. Moreover, the lower the mass of the black hole, the higher its temperature. So as the black hole loses mass, its temperature and rate of emission increase, so it loses mass more quickly. What happens when the mass of the black hole eventually becomes extremely small is not quite clear, but the most reasonable guess is that it would disappear completely in a tremendous final burst of emission, equivalent to the explosion of millions of H-bombs. A black hole with a mass a few times that of the Sun would have a temperature of only 1/10 millionth of a degree above absolute zero. This is much less than the temperature of the microwave radiation that fills the universe, about 2.7 above absolute zero, so such black holes would emit even less than they absorb. If the universe is destined to go on expanding forever, the temperature of the microwave radiation will eventually decrease to less than that of such a black hole, which will then begin to lose mass. But even then, its temperature would be so low that it would take about 1 million years, one with 66 zeros after it, to evaporate completely. This is much longer than the age of the universe, which is only about 10 or 20,000 million years, one or two with 10 zeros after it. On the other hand, as mentioned in Chapter 6, there might be primordial black holes with a very much smaller mass that were made by the collapse of irregularities in the very early stages of the universe. Such black holes would have a much higher temperature and would be emitting radiation at a much higher rate. A primordial black hole with an initial mass of 1,000 million tons would have a lifetime roughly equal to the age of the universe. Primordial black holes with initial masses less than this figure would already have completely evaporated, but those with slightly greater masses would still be emitting radiation in the form of X-rays and gamma rays. These X-rays and gamma rays are like waves of light, but with a much shorter wavelength. Such holes hardly deserve the epithet black. They really are white hot and are emitting energy at a rate of about 10,000 megawatts. One such black hole could run 10 large power stations if only we could harness the power. This will be rather difficult, however. The black hole would have the mass of a mountain compressed into less than 1 million millionth of an inch, the size of the nucleus of an atom. If you have one of these black holes on the surface of the Earth, there would be no way to stop it from falling through the floor to the center of the Earth. It would oscillate through the Earth and back until eventually it settled down at the center. So the only place to put such a black hole in which one might use the energy that it emitted would be in orbit around the Earth. And the only way that one could get it to orbit the Earth would be to attract it there by towing a large mass in front of it, rather like a carrot in front of a donkey. This doesn't sound like a very practical proposition, at least not in the immediate future. But even if we cannot harness the emission from these primordial black holes, what are our chances of observing them? We could look for the gamma rays that the primordial black holes emit during most of their lifetime. Although the radiation from most would be very weak because they are far away, the total from all of them might be detectable. However, this background could have been and probably was generated by processes other than primordial black holes. One can therefore say that the observations of the gamma ray background do not provide any positive evidence for primordial black holes, but they do tell us that on average there cannot be more than 300 in every cubic light year in the universe. This limit means that primordial black holes could make up most 1 millionth of the matter in the universe. With primordial black holes being so scarce, it might seem unlikely that there would be one near enough for us to observe as an individual source of gamma rays, but since gravity would draw primordial black holes toward any matter, they should be much more common in and around galaxies. So although the gamma ray background tells us that there can be no more than 300 primordial black holes per cubic light year on average, it tells us nothing about how common they might be in our galaxy. If they were, say, a million times more common than this, then the nearest black hole to us would probably be at a distance of about 1,000 million kilometers, or about as far away as Pluto, the farthest known planet. At this distance, it would still be very difficult to detect the steady emission of a black hole, even if it was 10,000 megawatts. In order to observe a primordial black hole, one would have to detect several gamma-ray quanta coming from the same direction within a reasonable space of time, such as a week. Otherwise, they might simply be part of the background. But Planck's quantum principle tells us that each gamma-ray quantum has a very high energy, because gamma rays have a very high frequency, so it would not take many quanta to radiate even 10,000 megawatts. And to observe these few coming from the distance of Pluto would require a larger gamma-ray detector than any that have been constructed thus far. Moreover, the detector would have to be in space, because gamma rays cannot penetrate the atmosphere. Of course, if a black hole as close as Pluto were to reach the end of its life and blow up, it would be easy to detect the final burst of emission. But if the black hole has been emitting for the last 10 or 20,000 million years, the chance of it reaching the end of its life within the next few years, rather than several million years in the past or future, well, it's really rather small. So in order to have a reasonable chance of seeing an explosion before your research grant ran out, you'd have to find a way to detect any explosions within a distance of about one light year. You'd still have the problem of needing a large gamma-ray detector to observe several gamma-ray quanta from the explosion. However, in this case, it would not be necessary to determine that all the quanta came from the same direction. It would be enough to observe that they all arrived within a very short time interval to be reasonably confident that they were coming from the same burst. One gamma-ray detector that might be capable of spotting primordial black holes is the entire Earth's atmosphere. We are in any case unlikely to be able to build a larger detector. When a high-energy gamma-ray quantum hits the atoms in our atmosphere, it creates pairs of electrons and positrons, anti-electrons. When these hit other atoms, they in turn create more pairs of electrons and positrons, so one gets what is called an electron shower. The result is a form of light called Cherenkov radiation. One can therefore detect gamma-ray bursts by looking for flashes of light in the night sky. Of course, there are a number of other phenomena, such as lightning and reflections of sunlight off tumbling satellites and orbiting debris, that can also give flashes in the sky. One could distinguish gamma-ray bursts from such effects by observing flashes simultaneously at two or more fairly widely separated locations. A search like this has been carried out by two scientists from Dublin, Neil Porter and Trevor Weeks, using telescopes in Arizona. They found a number of flashes, but none that could be definitely ascribed to gamma-ray bursts from primordial black holes. Even if the search for primordial black holes proves negative, as it seems it may, it will still give us important information about the very early stages of the universe. If the early universe had been chaotic or irregular, or if the pressure of matter had been low, one would have expected it to produce many more primordial black holes than the limit already set by our observations of the gamma-ray background. Only, if the early universe was very smooth and uniform with a high pressure, can one explain the absence of observable numbers of primordial black holes. The idea of radiation from black holes was the first example of a prediction that depended in an essential way on both the great theories of the century, general relativity and quantum mechanics. It aroused a lot of opposition initially because it upset the existing viewpoint. How can a black hole emit anything? When I first announced the results of my calculations at a conference at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory near Oxford, I was greeted with general incredulity. At the end of my talk, the chairman of the session, John G. Taylor from King's College London, claimed it was all nonsense. He even wrote a paper to that effect. However, in the end, most people, including John Taylor, have come to the conclusion that black holes must radiate like hot bodies if our other ideas about general relativity and quantum mechanics are correct. Thus, even though we have not yet managed to find a primordial black hole, there is fairly general agreement that if we did, it would have to be emitting a lot of gamma rays and X-rays. The existence of radiation from black holes seems to imply that gravitational collapse is not as final and irreversible as we once thought. If an astronaut falls into a black hole, its mass will increase, but eventually the energy equivalent of that extra mass will be returned to the universe in the form of radiation. Thus, in a sense, the astronaut will be recycled. It will be a poor sort of immortality, however, because any person or personal concept of time for the astronaut would almost certainly come to an end as he was torn apart inside the black hole. Even the types of particles that were eventually emitted by the black hole would in general be different from those that made up the astronaut. The only feature of the astronaut that would survive would be his mass or energy. The approximations I use to derive the emissions from black holes should work well when the black hole has a mass greater than a fraction of a gram. However, they will break down at the end of the black hole's life when its mass gets very small. The most likely outcome seems to be that the black hole will just disappear, at least from our region of the universe, taking with it the astronaut and any singularity there might be inside it, if indeed there is one. This was the first indication that quantum mechanics might remove the singularities that were predicted by general relativity. However, the methods that I and other people were using in 1974 were not able to answer questions such as whether singularities would occur in quantum gravity. From 1975 onward, I therefore started to develop a more powerful approach to quantum gravity based on Richard Feynman's idea of a sum of over histories. The answers that this approach suggests for the origin and fate of the universe and its contents, such as astronauts, will be described in the next two chapters. We shall see that although the uncertainty principle places limitations on the accuracy of all our predictions, it may at the same time remove the fundamental unpredictability that occurs at a space-time singularity.